This danger does not exist when he is officiating, because he acts by proxy, in place of the dead lending him his voice, so that the effect of the magic words is felt by the dead man, not by the lama. Once the psychic power of drawing the spirit out of its corporeal envelope has been conferred, by a competent master, upon a disciple, the latter must practice the uttering of hic, in the right tone. It is known that this has been attained when a straw stuck in the skull stands up straight as long as desired, for by shouting hic, a slight opening in the skull is produced and the straw is placed in it. In the case of a dead man, the opening is much larger. It is sometimes large enough to introduce the little finger. Dewis and Up was much interested in all questions concerning death and the spirit world. 5 or 6 years after I knew him, he translated a classic Tibetan work on the peregrinations of the dead in the next world, and the dreadful gods hoping to gain supernormal powers. Everything that concerned the mysterious world of beings generally invisible strongly attracted him, but the necessity of earning his living made it impossible for him to devote much time to his favorite study. Born in Klimpong, his ancestors were hillmen, Bhutanese or Sikkimese from the Tibetan stock of the invaders. He got a scholarship and was educated at the High School of Darjeeling, established for young men of Tibetan origin. He entered the British government service in India and became interpreter at Bakstar, on the southern frontier of Bhutan. I got some idea of this teacher from the accounts of Dewis and Up, who venerated him deeply. He must have resembled many lamas whom I have met later on, harboring in his mind a mixture of learning and superstitions, but, above all, a good and charitable man. He was distinguished from all his colleagues, however, by having had as master a veritable saint whose death is worth relating. This holy lama was an anchorite who practiced mystic contemplation in a secluded spot in Bhutan. As is often the case, one of his disciples shared his hermitage and served him. One day a pious benefactor came to see the ascetic and left him a sum of money to purchase winter provisions. His disciple, urged on by covetousness, stabbed him and ran off with the silver. The aged lama was still alive, and came to his senses soon after the murderer had gone. His wounds caused him excruciating suffering, and to escape this torture he sank into meditation. Concentration of thought is carried so far by Tibetan mystics that it becomes anesthetic and they do not feel anything, or at a lower degree of power they can thus greatly lessen their pains. When another disciple of the Lama went to visit him a few days later, he found him rolled up in a blanket and motionless. The smell from the festering wounds and the blood-stained blanket caught his attention. He questioned his master. The hermit then told him what had happened, but when the man wished to get a doctor from the nearest monastery, he was forbidden to do so. If the lamas and villagers happen to hear about my condition, they will search for the culprit, said the ascetic. He cannot have got far. They would find him and, probably, condemn him to death. I cannot permit this. I wish to give him more time to escape. One day he will, perhaps, return to the right path. And in any case, I shall not have been the cause of his death. So do not tell anyone what you have seen here. Now go, leave me alone. While I meditate, I do not suffer, but when I become conscious of my body, my pain is unbearable. An Oriental disciple does not discuss an order of this kind. The man prostrated himself at his guru ~S16.guru, in Sanskrit, the spiritual father and guide. This word is used by Tibetan mystics, especially in book language. 16 feet and left. A few days later the hermit, all alone in his hut, passed away. Although Dewis and Up greatly admired the conduct of the holy lama, such moral summits were not for him. He humbly confessed it. Drink, a failing frequent among his countrymen, had been the curse of his life. This increased his natural tendency to anger and led him, one day, within the nace of murder. I had some influence over him while I lived at Gangtok. I persuaded him to promise the total abstinence from fermented beverages that is enjoined on all Buddhists. But it needed more energy than he possessed to persevere. It was impossible for him to resist his surroundings, where men say that to drink, and leave one's reason at the bottom of the cup, is the proper thing for a faithful disciple of Padmasambhava. Padmasambhava belonged to the degenerate sect of Tantric Buddhism. Yet, nothing proves he was naturally intemperate, as some of his followers wish to make us believe, to justify their drunkenness. When I met Dewasandhap, he had left the government service to become headmaster of the Tibetan school at Gangtok. He was too extraordinary for words in this role. His passion for reading literally tyrannized the man. Wherever he went, he carried a book with him and, absorbed in it, he lost himself in a kind of ecstasy. For hours he would forget where he was. His learned translations, his long conversations with lamas and the celebrating of occult rites constantly distracted him from attending to his school. Indeed, he often seemed to have forgotten its very existence. Sometimes for a whole month he did not set foot in the schoolroom, abandoning his scholars to the care of an undermaster, who followed his example in neglecting them, as far as he dared without risking his job. Left to themselves, the boys played and wandered in the woods, forgetting the little they had learned. However, the day would come when Dewasandhap, severe as a judge of the dead, suddenly appeared before his pupils, who trembled in every limb, knowing full well what they had to expect. First, they had to stand in a line in front of their examiner, who then questioned a boy at one or the other end of the line. If the child gave an incorrect answer, or none at all, his comrade next in line might answer, and if his solution was right, he was ordered to slap the ignorant in the face and take his place. The victim was again questioned. If he did not show more learning than the first time, the third in line was called up, and if successful, would be told to slap his comrade and take his place. An unlucky urchin, stupefied by these repeated brutalities, reached the end of the row, having received a dozen blows. Not infrequently it happened that several boys standing side by side were incapable of reciting their lessons. In that case, the most erudite of the group distributed all the slaps, and if all the children showed themselves equally ignorant, Dewasandhap himself chastised them all. Certain pupils hesitated to give a friend a hard blow and only made a presence of striking him, but Dewasandhap was on the lookout. "Come up here," he would say, with a little ferocious laugh. "You do not know how it is done, my boy. I'll teach you." And bang! His large hand would strike the poor lad in the face. Then the boy had to demonstrate, on his friend's cheek, that he had learned the lesson given by his terrible teacher. Sometimes the faults to be punished were not connected with the pupil's work. In that strange school, devoid of all discipline, the inventive mind of Dewasandhap discovered transgressions to rules which had never been made. In these cases, he used a specially long and heavy stick, ordering the culprit to stretch out his arm and keep his hand open. Then the boy received on his palm the number of strokes fixed by his master. As he maneuvered his weapon, Dewasandhap executed a kind of savage war dance, marking each stroke with a leap and a wild exclamation of ban. So, with the active though unwilling cooperation of the victim, whose pain caused him to stamp, writhe and yell, the punishment looked like a devilish ballet. Arriving unexpectedly at the school one day, I witnessed one of these scenes, and the children, who became familiar with me, frankly described their teacher's educational methods. After a few days of this active professorship, Dewasandhap would again abandon his pupils. I could tell many other stories about my good interpreter, some quite amusing, in the style of Boccaccio. He played other parts than those of occultist, schoolmaster and writer. But, peace to his memory. I do not wish to belittle him. Having acquired real erudition by persevering efforts, he was sympathetic and interesting. I congratulate myself on having met him and gratefully acknowledge my debt to him. I may add that Dewasandhap is the author of the first, and up to now, only English-Tibetan dictionary, and that he ended his days as professor of Tibetan at the University of Calcutta. My joy was intense when the Prince Tulku announced that a real Tibetan doctor of philosophy from the famous University of Trashalumpo was coming to live at the Inch Monastery, near Gangtok, and that he also expected another Lama, a native from Sikkim, who had studied in Tibet, to return shortly to his country. I soon was able to meet these two men and found them learned and distinguished scholars. The doctor of philosophy's name was Kushog. Tibetan equivalent of Sir Chostst, and he belonged to the family of the ancient kings of Tibet. He had been some years in prison for some political offense, and attributed his delicate state of health to poisoned food absorbed during his incarceration. The Prince of Sikkim held men of learning in high esteem. He was glad to receive the refugee and appointed him abbot of the Inchgompa, with the further duty of teaching grammar and sacred literature to about 20 novices. Kushog Chostst was a Jelugspa, that is to say a follower of the reformed sect founded by Tsongkhapa about AD 1400, familiarly known as the Sect of the Yellow Hats. Foreign writers who describe the doctrines and religious practices of the Yellow Hats as completely opposed to those of the Red Hats would have recognized their error on finding, at Inch Monastery, a Jelugspa abbot presiding over monks of the Red sect and chanting the liturgy with them. I do not know whether this Lama gave himself assiduously to meditation and should be classed as a mystic, but he certainly possessed extraordinary erudition. His memory resembled a miraculous library, where each book was ready at the asking, to open at the desired page. Without the slightest effort he could quote texts by the dozen, on any matter connected with Lamaism, Buddhist philosophy and Tibetan history or secular literature. This is, however, not an unusual feat in Tibet, but his perfect understanding and subtle comprehension of shades of meaning was quite uncommon. Whether from fear of being thought obtrusive or from pride of birth, the Lama seldom visited the prince at his villa, and only to consult with him about affairs concerning the monastery. Sometimes he came to see me, but I generally went up to his gompa, which stood on a spur of the mountain that dominated Gangtok. After several conversations, the Lama, suspicious as are most Orientals, devised an amusing stratagem to test my knowledge of Buddhism and the extent of my understanding of its doctrines. One day when I was seated in his room, he took out of a drawer a long list of questions and with exquisite politeness asked me to answer them at once. The subjects treated were abstruse and had certainly been chosen with the intention of embarrassing me. I passed the trial honorably, my examiner seemed content. He then confessed that up to this moment he had not believed me to be a Buddhist and that, not being able to discover my reasons for questioning the Lamas about their religion, he had feared that my designs were evil. After this he seemed quite reassured and manifested great confidence in me. The second Lama who arrived shortly after this at Gangtok came from the monastery of Tolungtsephug, situated in the region of Lhasa. He had studied there in his youth, and returned later as secretary to the head of the sect of the Karmapas, one of the most important Red Hat sects. He was called Bermag Kushog. The Honorable of Bermag, because he was the son of the lord of that place, one of the rare members of the Sikkimese nobility who belonged to the aboriginal race called the Lepchas. Like Kushog Chostst, he had received the higher ordination of Jalong and was a celibate. He was chaplain to the Maharaja and, as such, occupied an apartment in the palace. Nearly every afternoon he crossed the gardens and went to the villa where the crown prince lived. There in the sitting room furnished according to English taste, we had long conversations on topics quite foreign to Westerners. I like to recall these talks which gradually enabled me to lift the veil that hides the real Tibet and its religious world. Sidkong Tulku, always wearing his brocade robes, presided, seated on a couch. A table was placed in front of him, and I sat opposite, in an armchair. We were each provided with a little bowl of fine Chinese porcelain, with a silver saucer and a cover shaped like a pagoda roof, studded with coral and turquoises. At a short distance from the prince, the Honorable of Bermag, majestically draped in his garnet-colored toga, had an armchair and a bowl with a silver saucer, but without a cover. As for Dwisandup, who was often present, he squatted tailor at our feet and his bowl, placed upon the rug, had neither cover nor saucer. While that learned and fluent orator, Bermag Kushog, talked, we were lavishly supplied with Tibetan tea, the color of faded roses and flavored with butter and salt. Rich Tibetans always have a bowl of this tea near at hand. A popular expression to describe wealthy people is, their lips are always moistened with tea or beer. However, fact he only appeared in these reunions, out of respect for my orthodox Buddhist principles, a young attendant brought in a large silver teapot. He carried it around shoulder high and lowered it to the level of our cups with studied gestures, as if he was performing some religious rite. A few sticks of incense burning in a corner of the room, spread a penetrating fragrance unlike any I had ever smelt in India or in China. Sometimes, a slow solemn melody, at once melancholy and subdued, reached us from the distant palace temple. And Burmak Lama continued talking, describing the lives and thoughts of some sages or magicians who had lived or were living today, in the Forbidden Land, whose front ear was so near. To Kushog Chost and to Burmak Kushog I owe my first initiation into the creeds held by the Lamaists regarding death and the beyond, creeds unknown to most foreigners. As one of these lamas was Red Hat, and the other belonged to the Yellow Hat sect, by listening to both, I was sure of acquiring information that represented the general opinion and not that of any one particular sect or creed. Moreover, in the years that followed, I had numerous occasions, in different parts of Tibet, of questioning other lamas on this subject. For the convenience of the reader, I will put together some of this information in the following summary. Death and the Beyond. The profane generally imagine that Buddhists believe in the reincarnation of the soul and even in metempsychosis. This is erroneous. Buddhism teaches that the energy produced by the mental and physical activities of a being brings about the apparition of new mental and physical phenomena when once this being has been dissolved by death. There exist a number of subtle theories upon this subject, and the Tibetan mystics seem to have attained a deeper insight into the question than most other Buddhists. However, in Tibet, as elsewhere, the views of the philosophers are only understood by the elite. The masses, although they repeat the orthodox creed, all aggregates are impermanent, no ego exists in the person, nor in anything, remain attached to the more simple belief in an undefined entity traveling from world to world, assuming various forms. The ideas of the Lamaists regarding the condition of man immediately after death differ from those held by the Buddhists of the southern countries, Ceylon, Burma, Siam. They affirm that a certain time elapses between his death and his rebirth among one or other of the six kinds of recognized sentient beings. According to popular belief, the class of beings in which one is reborn and the more or less happy conditions in which one is placed among them, depend upon the good and evil actions one has accomplished during one's previous existence. The more enlightened lamas teach that man, or any other being, by his thoughts and actions, creates affinities which, quite naturally, lead him to a kind of existence in keeping with the nature of these affinities. Others say that, by his actions, and above all, by his mental activity, he modifies his very substance and so acquires the characteristics of a god, an animal, or of any kind of being. So far, these views differ very little from those expressed among Buddhists. The following Lamaist theories are more original. In the first place, the great importance given to cleverness by certain Mahayana Buddhist sects is still more emphasized by Lamaists. He who knows how to go about it could live comfortably even in hell, is a very popular saying in Tibet. This explains more clearly than any definition or description all that the lamas mean by thabs, that is method. Thus, while most of their co-religionists believe that the fate of the dead is mathematically fixed in accordance with their moral character, the Lamaists declare that he who knows the proper method is capable of modifying for the better his post-mortem fate. In other words, he may cause himself to be reborn in the most agreeable conditions possible. They say, as agreeable as possible, because in spite of cleverness, the weight of past actions has considerable force. In fact, it is often so powerful that all the efforts of a dead being, or of an initiate devoted to his welfare, are unable to stop the spirit from precipitating itself into a miserable rebirth. We shall have an illustration of this difficulty a little later. Starting with the idea that method, the savoir-faire, is of an essential importance, the Lamaists think that after having learned the art of living well, one must learn the art of dying well and of doing well in other worlds. Initiates acquainted with mystic lore are supposed to know what awaits them when they die, and contemplative lamas have foreseen and experienced, in this life, the sensations that accompany death. They will, therefore, neither be surprised nor troubled when their present personality disintegrates. That which is to continue, entering conscious into the next world, will be already familiar with the roads and bypaths and the places to which they lead. What is this that which continues its way after the body has become a corpse? It is a special consciousness among the several distinguished by Lamaists. The consciousness of the I, or according to another definition, the will to live. I shall use the term spirit for the traveler whose peregrinations in the next world we are to follow. This term is far from conveying exactly the idea which earned Tibetans embody in the words Yidkaya Rinpa Shespa. But it has the advantage of being familiar to Westerners and, indeed, there is none more suitable in any European language. I said that, according to Tibetans, a mystic initiate is capable of keeping his mind lucid during the disintegration of his personality, and that it is possible to him to pass from this world to the next fully conscious of what is happening. It follows that such a man does not need the help of anyone in his last hours, nor any religious rites after his death. But this is not the case for ordinary mortals. By ordinary mortals, we must understand anyone, monk or layman, who has not mastered the science of death, and these are, naturally, the great majority. Lamaism does not abandon these ignorants to themselves. While they are dying, and after they are dead, a Lama teaches them that which they have not learned while they were alive. He explains to them the nature of the beings and things which appear on their way, he reassures them, and, above all, he never ceases guiding them in the right direction. The Lama who is assisting a dying man is careful to prevent him from falling asleep, or from fainting or falling into a coma. He points out the successive departure of the special consciousness attached to each sense, viz. Consciousness of the eye, consciousness of the nose, of the tongue, of the body, of the ear. That is to say, he calls attention to the gradual loss of sight, smell, taste, touch and hearing. Then, the task of the Lama is to make the spirit spring out of its envelope through the top of the head, for if it leaves by any other road, the future well-being of the man will be greatly jeopardized. This extraction of the spirit is produced by the ritualistic cry of Hik, followed by Fat. Before uttering the cry, the Lama must concentrate his thoughts and identify himself with the man who has just died. He must make the effort which the man himself ought to have made, to cause the spirit to ascend to the summit of the skull with sufficient force to produce the fissure through which it can escape. Initiates who are capable of making the spirit rise for themselves, utter the liberating cries of Hik and Fat. When they feel their end approaching, and so free themselves without help, they are also able to commit suicide in this way, and it is said that certain mystics have done so. The disembodied spirit then begins a strange pilgrimage. The popular belief is that a journey really takes place through lands that really exist and are peopled with real beings. But the more learned Lamaists consider the journey as a series of subjective visions, a dream that the spirit himself weaves under the influence of his character and his past actions. Certain Lamaists assert that, immediately after the spirit has been disincarnated, it has an intuition, fugitive as a streak of lightning, of the supreme reality. If it can seize this light, it is definitely set free from the round of successive births and deaths. It has reached the state of nirvana. This is rarely the case. Generally, the spirit is dazzled by this sudden light. He shrinks from it, pulled backward by his false conceptions, his attachment to individual existence and to the pleasure of the senses. Or, else, the significance of what he has seen escapes him, just as a man, absorbed by his preoccupations, will fail to notice what is going on around him. The ordinary man who has died while in a faint does not immediately understand what has happened when he becomes conscious again. For several days he will talk to people living in his former dwelling place, and he will be astonished that no one answers him or seems to be aware of his presence. A Lama of the monastery of Litang, in eastern Tibet, told me that some dead men had communicated through the intermediary of Porwos, the fact that they had tried to use objects belonging to them. They wanted to take a plow to work their fields or to reach their clothes which were hanging on a hook and put them on. They were irritated at not being able to carry on the life to which they were accustomed. In such cases, the spirit of the dead is disoriented. What can have happened to him? He notices an inert body similar to his own and sees the lamas chanting around him. Is it possible that he is dead? Simple people believe that the disincarnated spirit must go to a sandy spot and observe his footprints on the ground. If these footprints are reversed, that is to say if the heels are in front and the toes turned backwards, he can no longer doubt that he is dead. We may as well ask how a spirit can possess feet. It is not really the spirit which is provided with limbs, but the ethereal double to which he is still attached. For Tibetans, like Egyptians, believe in the double. During life, in a normal state, this double is closely united with the material body. Nevertheless, certain circumstances may cause their separation. The double can, then, leave the material body and show itself in different places, or being itself invisible, it can accomplish various peregrinations. With some people this separation of the double from the body happens involuntarily, but Tibetans say that those who have trained themselves for the purpose can effect it at will. The separation, however, is not complete, for a strand subsists, connecting the two forms. The link persists during a certain length of time after death. The destruction of the corpse generally, but not necessarily, brings about the destruction of the double in the end. In certain cases, it may survive its companion. In Tibet, one meets people who have been in a state of lethargy, and are able to describe the various places in which, they say, they have traveled. Some have only visited countries inhabited by men, while others can tell of their peregrinations in the paradises, the purgatories or in the Buddho, an intermediary region where spirits wander after death, while waiting to be reincarnated. These curious travelers are called deologues, which means, one who has returned from the beyond. Though the deologues vary in their descriptions of places and events, they usually agree in depicting the feelings of the pseudo-dead as definitely pleasant. A woman whom I met in a village of Zarong had some years ago, remained inanimate for a whole week. She said she had been agreeably astonished by the lightness and agility of her new body and the extraordinary rapidity of its movements. She had only to wish herself in a certain place to be there immediately. She could cross rivers, walking upon the waters, or pass through walls. There was only one thing she found impossible, to cut an almost impalpable cord that attached her ethereal being to the material body which she could see perfectly well sleeping upon her couch. This cord lengthened out indefinitely but, nevertheless, it sometimes hampered her movements. She would get caught up in it, she said. A male deologue, whom my son had met in his youth, gave a similar description of his state. Evidently, the deologue is not really a dead man, so that nothing can prove that the sensations he experiences in his lethargy are the same as those felt by the dead. Tibetans, however, do not seem to be troubled by this distinction. When the dying man has taken his last breath, he is dressed by putting his clothes on backwards, the front of the gown fastened on his back. Then he is tied up with his legs crossed, or his knees bent and touching his breast. In the villages, the body, dressed in this way, is usually placed in a cauldron. As soon as the corpse has been taken out for its journey to the cemetery, this cauldron is hastily washed, and soup or tea is often prepared in it for the funeral guests who do not seem troubled by fear of infection from the corpse. In Tibet, funeral ceremonies occupy many days, and though the high altitude of the central and northern provinces retards decomposition, in the hot and damp valleys, corpses kept for a week or longer spread a putrid odor. This does not in the least affect the appetite of the officiating trippers, who continue to advise the dead, signaling the roads he should follow and those he should avoid in the next world. They take their meals facing the departed one. One may even say they eat with him, for the chief monk invites him by names as follows: Spirit, come here, immediately, and feed yourself. In the wooded regions of Tibet, the bodies are burned. The inhabitants of the vast barren northern and central regions, where cow dung is the only fuel available, abandon the corpses to the beasts of prey, either in cemeteries reserved near the villages, or anywhere on the mountain solitudes. The bodies of high religious dignitaries are sometimes preserved by the double process of salting and cooking in butter. These mummies are called mardong.